Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I've got one of the early Mixergy fans here who's built up a phenomenal business. He's going to come here to talk about how he built his business. And you know, guys, I've been really obsessed with chatbots. You know, this experience where instead of going to someone's website or downloading their app, you go into a chat app like Facebook Messenger and you start chatting with the company's software. And you sometimes will get to chat with the company's founder too. And I think that that's the future of company to human interactions, company to client or prospect interactions. And so the more curious I got about this space, the more I found out about this company called Master of Code. I thought of them as just chatbot makers because their chatbots are, well, their clients for chatbots are some really heavy hitter brands, and they're pretty cutting edge with the way that they make chatbots. But it turns out they do way more than that. They're a software development company that's been around since 2004. They've worked with some really remarkable companies themselves and done other software and products. I invited the founder here, Dmitry Gritsenko. Well, that's not so hard. I'm pausing on it because I want to make sure to get it right. But Dmitry Gritsenko. Am I getting it right?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, super easy. It's like spelled phonetically. Is the founder of the company, and I'm excited to have him here to talk not just about chatbots, but I do want to know how, when this thing didn't exist, he jumped on it and grew his business so fast, but also about how he grew a company that creates software and keeps growing it. This interview is sponsored by two companies that you've heard me talk about for a long time. The first is the company that will host your website. It's called HostGator. The second is a company where you can, if you need to hire a developer or designer for your team, you can turn to them. It's called TopTal, but I'll tell you more about them later. First, Dmitry, good to have you here.
Yo, hey, awesome to be here. Like I said, you were the first podcast that I started listening to become a real entrepreneur. Like, you were the inspiration behind it, and like, I started listening to a number of things after you, but you were the first one.
Thanks. You know what? I was doing it at a time when people thought, oh, who would even want to do podcasting at all? People can't figure out podcasting. And thankfully, by getting in early, I got to meet a lot of early Y Combinator companies, a lot of early success stories. And as a result, this thing's come up. I want to know how big your company is. So let me ask you, what's your revenue right now?
So we're going to be talking about several companies in the loop here. So Master of Code is the company I started in 2004. And that's like the big ship. The company is 120 people. It's international, first of all.
120 employees.
Yes. And I started the company in Ukraine, and that's the biggest base so far. It's 120 people in Ukraine.
Okay.
All in one location, all, you know, in one office. So it's not like contractors, like all one building. And then 8 years ago, I moved to Canada, actually. Mm-hmm. Started an office there. It's five people there. We have an office in Denver, which is two people, and two people in New York. So that's how the company is geographically located. And I won't tell you the revenue for the service company. We might touch on the revenue for some of the spin-off businesses, like product businesses, but not the service company. It's a little bit of a, you know, like a little bit of a sensitive subject because Ukraine is not all that transparent when it concerns money, right? Like, it's like people perceive money a little differently. It's there is a lot of gap between people that earn well and people that barely make it. So you just want to be careful with the concept. And it's going to come to, like, Ukraine is getting more modernized and, you know, more like European country. So that's going to come more towards transparency and people are going to be more comfortable with money. But anytime there is certain, you know, distance between two groups of people, like the group that's unfortunate starts feeling pretty strong about the group that's making it well.
Yeah, and I specifically talked to you about this before we started the interview. I want to court more international companies, more entrepreneurs outside of the mainstream Silicon Valley and, frankly, North American archetype. And to do that, I think we need to be very open about how they can't discuss business the way that we can in the U.S., partially because it's cultural and partially, as you said, because of political issues in the countries. I interviewed an entrepreneur early on in Brazil who, at the end of the interview, I said, aren't you worried that what you said is going to get you kidnapped? Because I heard what was going on in Brazil at the time, and he suddenly hit him. He was acting like he was in Silicon Valley. He was thinking like he was in Silicon Valley, but he was living in Brazil in a tough environment. And back then I was cutting interviews out and not publishing it. So I gave him the opportunity to back away, and he immediately called me up after talking to his wife. He said, What did I do, Andrew? I got lulled into. So I accept it. I understand it. I got a sense of where the business is, though, size-wise. What I'm curious about is how you got started. You're a guy who didn't start out coding. You're a guy who started out translating. What kind of translation did you do?
So basically, my main in the university was English language and literature. I was supposed to be an English teacher. So being a teacher, like, you get paid so very little, like, you don't have a life to live. So I started looking for ways to earn more money. So I met some missionaries, actually, some missionaries from Canada. And I just, you know, got stuck to them and said, hey, guys, maybe you have a little bit of something. And like, yeah, luckily enough, they needed a translator. So I started stumbling along trying to translate. Then I started with them. Then I started with an IT company. And that's where my connection with IT happened.
Where you started doing some translation from English to, or from what language to English?
Russian, Ukrainian, and English, like any combination of these.
Got it. Okay. All right. And so you start working for a tech company, and then that gets you involved in technology and development. We'll talk about all that. I want to understand, like, a little bit of your background, because what I'm fascinated by is the number of customers you have. You don't have the background for bringing in this level of company as a client. How you structure your business so that you can onboard people properly. How do you take care of so many customers without having everyone, 120 people in the team, without having everyone kind of step on each other and create kind of a mishmash? I know it's been an issue, frankly, for us internally at Mixergy. What software do we use to organize? How do we onboard new people and so on? So I want to learn from that. But let's just continue with your background before we get into how you run your services business today and the spin-off software that's come from it. You get into a tech company. How do you then start coding? How do you go from a guy who knows three languages to a guy who knows how to code in multiple languages?
Right. So I actually wasn't too bad in math and physics. So that was kind of my main at school. And then I switched to linguistics for university. But then being in the software company, I first was like a teacher of English there and a translator. And then gradually they said, hey, do you want to try something out? And I was intrigued. So I started working with PHP and HTML. So I, you know, hacked something together. Then they put me on a commercial project. The company was called Intralink. I want to give them a little bit of credit for starting me on this path. And so I really enjoyed it, but I wasn't a person to sit around and code for long. So it was really big stress for me. But I saw that the guys that were doing this stuff were earning more than I was. And that was a big driver to me that time. So I was crying, literally crying, like we call them crocodile tears because they're big. So I was sitting down, I was teaching myself to code, and I, you know, finally when stuff started coming out and they could use some of that in commercial projects and sell that, like, you know, that gets you a boost. So I learned PHP, then I switched to Java. That was in the course of 2 years. And then they said, hey, you got good English, you got good communication skills, and you're technical now. Why don't you switch into management, which was like exactly what I loved, exactly where I thrived. I have done that for about a year. And then I switched companies where I was like a key manager at one other company called eCreative and spent about 2 years there. And after that, like I figured out, the ecosystem by myself. And I said, like, it's pretty straightforward. Like you find a client on the internet, you get some guys who know coding and you communicate between them. So that's how I basically started.
And that tapped into your beyond the math skills, beyond the language skills. You had entrepreneurial skills. You actually told our producer about all the different things that you were selling back when you were growing up. The thing that stood out for me is fish, smoked fish. What did you do with fish?
That was my granddad. So
You weren't buying fish and smoking them?
Well, listen to this. So my granddad, he really instilled this, like, you know, hardworking entrepreneurial culture in me and my cousin. Mm-hmm. So we'd be out in summer in his farm, and he'd bring like a truckload of fish. And fish was like, you know, 25 pound, 30 pound, like big fish. So we were like 10, 12. And he'd like hand over like 500 pounds of that fish to me and my cousin. And we were supposed to cut the freaking things. Gut them, slice them, and fillet them and get them ready, salt them, get them ready for smoking. Then once the fish got smoked, we would go together with the grandpa to the bazaar, to like a market, and sell that. Like at age of 12, you're selling smoked fish to like, you know, some hardcore guys bitching about, you know, like why so expensive, things like that. And that was Soviet Union. So that wasn't like free economy.
I see. And I could see how the why so expensive type questions would help make you a better entrepreneur right now, especially in the services space, right?
100%. Yeah.
Am I actually drawing too big of a conclusion, or is that true that actually did help you?
I honestly believe that was a big, big driver. Like we would, learn how to meet objections. So we would learn how to manage different people types and how to find rapport, how to just, how to come into contact with people better, like how to call them, hey, come here, buy this last, kilo of cherries or whatever. Like we want to go home, stuff like that.
Yeah, I used to sell sandwiches as a kid, and the fact that they expire puts real pressure on you to sell, because if you don't sell them, you have to throw them out. That means you can't procrastinate. Your money's going to go away. All right. You had a good job then. Why start your own business?
It's this big drive. Like I never had an easy life. It really was hard. Like family was a little tough. My mom took very good care of me. My dad, not so much. We lived in, kind of dire need. And so
your dad didn't take such good care of you?
He drank a lot.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And so my cousin, on the other hand, who I was close with, like his family was well off. And in Soviet Union, like you can just feel a difference. Like they would buy cars and things like that. And yeah. When we got our cheap old car, like I felt so, so happy. And like anything that moved me up that freaking, material ladder, certain period of time, like really was driving me very hard. So yeah, I realized I wanted to make more money. And I just had to find a way to make more money. Apparently that was growing a business and getting involved with a lot more people and a lot more clients.
And one of the nice things, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the nice things about starting a consulting business is it doesn't take a lot of upfront capital, and you can start off with your skills and just keep ramping up. Is that right?
Yeah.
The first thing that you focused on, was it WordPress and similar software?
Yeah. Like generally, software companies at that time would start with something simpler. And something like a smaller ticker, a project like that at that time would probably cost a custom WordPress type of website would be about, 200, 300 bucks. And a developer would get, close to that in a month. And so you can make, if you crank out two WordPresses a month with one developer, you're basically making one wage on top of it, right?
You're talking about a few hundred dollars per website that you would get paid?
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, that's practically nothing. But I guess, like you said, that your cost of labor was pretty...
Yeah.
I'm looking at an early version of your website, and it says, "Welcome to masterofcode.com, Ukraine-based software company." And the exclamation point, the excitement over it is that, look, we have lower costs than you will in the US, which is what the draw should be, right?
Right.
And you said, and you put your phone number right on the website, but you also linked everyone to your Skype, which is the exact same Skype email, the Skype name that you and I are now using to connect with each other. Sure. So it was like a very personal business.
Yeah.
You offered 2 hours max response time during working hours. How do you do that? Is it like during your working hours, or you mean the US hours?
So now we can offer that across the globe, except for Australia. During that time, it was during Ukrainian working hours, which wasn't super elegant. It was a little bit more of a sales pitch, but we stuck to it. Like if we worked till 8 p.m. in the office, we'd really make an effort to have 2 hours max response time.
And what I like about this page is you didn't have much experience or track record as a company back when this page that I'm looking at was built, but you explain, look, we have all this experience. It's like we've done offshore development for 6 years, meaning not you at this company, but you as a person has, right? And so you're bringing that to bear here. All right, where did you get your first customers? How did you get these people who are paying you a few hundred bucks?
That would be some of those online marketplaces, similar to Upwork. I forget what they were called, like Elance and Rent-A-Coder.
You were on those sites?
Oh, yeah. Like, that's
really?
How
I always wondered about those companies. I thought they were small and they were always going to stay small. So for you, this was an onboarding into bigger businesses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And what I am surprised with is that still some companies in Ukraine that would be like 10, 20 companies, most of their stuff would come off of those profiles. Like they were consistent. Yeah. Keeping up their profiles and, you know, gradually raising rates because they're 5 stars, because they had 10 ratings or 20 ratings. And so there is some work to be done there, no doubts. But the amount of junk you get there and amount of people that, you know, don't appreciate work enough is also pretty high.
Who was contacting people on Upwork? In other words, if I went to Upwork and looked for, I guess it wasn't Upwork at the time, but if I went to one of these freelance sites at the time and I tried to hire a developer, who would contact me back? Was it you at the time?
Yeah. I stretched myself thin throughout most of the growth of the company.
Okay.
So I would be like on every front. And it wasn't because of lack of trust. Like I probably had the best English and I had best overall understanding of what kind of project we were able to bid for, what kind of promises we were able to make, because you talk to developers and, you know, they think they can do everything. But you got to realize like there has to be a specific context that you can serve so that you can get your rating.
All right. Today you have some really fantastic clients. Who are some of the big names that people would recognize?
Some of the biggest names are probably under NDA that I cannot mention. But some of the still big names that we're proud of is World Surf League, MTV, T-Mobile, eBags, Helzberg Diamonds, companies like that.
What do you do for T-Mobile?
We're working on their chatbot experiences.
Yeah. I thought that you were releasing some of the names of the companies that you work with. Like, don't you do something for MTV?
Yeah.
We do, right? I've seen a list of all the companies. I won't disclose them if you don't feel comfortable disclosing, but you have some major companies, major brands. Why would they NDA you? Why wouldn't they let people know that you're the ones who did it for them?
I don't understand some of the policies they run, but some of the companies just tell us straightforward, like we read through all the contracts and everything, like the legal department does that now. And so, you know, one of the biggest things for us, hey guys, we want to be able to tell about you because like we're proud of
right.
you, we have invested in the relationship. And if you're working with us, isn't it, you know, reciprocal, right? But for some of them, they just say, hey, we don't allow any vendor who we work with to talk about us. And apparently, like the way I read it is they just want to keep that purity of the brand unattached to anything else. It's so unique, it's so outstanding, it's so on its own that it has to be self-contained and not, you know, surrounded by anything.
I guess I get that. And I guess they don't want you to just to use their brand, to use their name, I guess. All right. Mm-hmm. So how did you make the leap from the freelance sites to the major brands? And in fact, why don't we take a moment to your pause and then we'll come back and talk about it. The pause is to talk about a company called TopTal. Before the interview started, I did with you what I do with everyone else that I interview. I said, do you mind me talking about TopTal? And especially for you, because you have your company that people could hire to build out software. You said, no, I don't have a problem with them. In fact, you've had experience. What was the experience that you or the people on your team have had with TopTal? Top isn't top of the mountain, Tal isn't talent, by the way, guys. What was your experience with them?
Right. So first of all, not a competitor because they're probably like in a very special league, which is awesome. Like they just focus on the top stuff, most expensive, like, you know, expensive and top rated talent. And they scrutinize their people to the extent where like very, very few developers can really make the list. And I know developers that tried to make the list because it's attractive, first of all. And it's just like, you know, big boost to the ego. But there was only one person that I think did it out of 5+ people that I know tried.
Who tried? And you're saying just getting through that process is enough of an ego boost or something you can boast about. And I see, yeah, I saw your eyes just open wide from that. I know, and I've talked about this before, I know entrepreneurs who are here in Silicon Valley who've tried and couldn't get in. I know one CTO of a few big companies here who tried to get into TopTal and couldn't. And I wonder, I guess if they exclude them, I wonder what the people who they do let in are like. That's really interesting. And then if they are that good, why aren't they CTOs? Maybe those people don't have the kind of management skills or desire to be managers as the person who got rejected, who's really a top developer. All right, well, guys, you heard it right here, and I've talked about it before. TopTal wants to focus not on the cheapest developers out there, but on the best of the best developers. In fact, there are agencies right now who have very few people working within the agencies, but when a client needs some work that they don't have a developer who can do, they go to TopTal and they say, "Psst, TopTal, we need a great developer. They hire a developer from TopTal, and then they bring that developer to their clients, and that developer is kind of a representative of the business. The client never even knows that it's TopTal who sent over that developer. So if you guys are out there and you need to hire the best of the best developer, or even sometimes teams of developers to come into your company and help you grow, I urge you to go not to TopTal.com, but to a special URL that I'm about to give you, where they're going to give Mixergy listeners 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours, and that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. That URL is toptal.com/Mixergy. Also founded by two Mixergy fans. Top as in top of your head, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. Go check them out. All right, so let's talk about the leap. You start off with these lower-end companies. How do you get to these people that I so admire you for having as customers? What was the first big milestone to jump to that level?
So it's realizing that communicating value from Ukraine, like over the ocean, like with a little bit different mentality, is just tough. Like, you know, there is still that apprehension that anything that happens like at a distance, you don't really have control over. And before the world got used to the fact that it's global and it's not about where the team is located, it's about the quality of the resource that you get to work with. Like you really had to be there personally to try and prove the value, to try to, you know, to just communicate better, shake hands, make sure that everything's real. You sign papers there in person, things like that. So at the point when we realized that, and I don't remember which year that was, but we decided, hey, we got to invest in the North American presence. And so we started going out to Europe, to Western Europe and to the States, making personal connections with the clients that would be, you know, similar clients, but a little bit higher caliber, and they would require personal visits. And so finally, it wasn't a leap. It was like a gradual progression. So you start flying, you start meeting. Okay, that's, you know, a step up in the level of clients you meet and the level of business you start doing. Then you realize you got to have a local presence somewhere in the North American continent. And so you set up an office and you partner or hire a person there, and the person represents you as a sales or business developer or a project manager. And when they have somebody on site there, that, you know, that creates for even more comfortable relationship. So once that was established, so like I said, we have an office in Denver, for example. So like we started working with eBags from Denver, which is like, you know, a very outstanding company out there. And like if we didn't have an office there, I don't think that business would have been possible, because like a big business like that still wants to have somebody to account manage, come to their office, talk to them. It has to be, you know, not too often, once a month, once in 2 months even. But the fact is still there.
So. Yeah, I'm looking at my notes here and research. You at some point just started going to a bunch of events, like you were at the Lean Startup Machine event. You were at the iDate. That's an event for the dating industry. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then on December 22nd, 2011, there's a big announcement on your site. We opened a new sales office in New York. And so that's the gradual transition from going to events, and some of them are frankly pretty small, to bigger events, and then having an office where somebody can go and where someone who represents you can go into your client's office and meet them. That's the big transition that helps you get there.
Yeah.
So I have to tell you though, going to events like Lean Startup Machine and the others are interesting, but how do you actually get customers from there? How do you know which ones are going to be worthwhile? How do you follow up with people? What was your process back then?
A lot of it was like clumsy trying to figure out how, right? And like there is no recipe for it. So first of all, you go in and you try to orient yourself. Like you try to figure out like what kind of people are here, right? And a lot of the people there would be the kind of people that you are. Like they're looking for business, and you know, sometimes the events are going to be pro business making. Sometimes they're going to be, you know, against that. Like you know, any hint at pitching the service at any of the pitches at Lean Startup Machine was banned. Like I had to be very careful that I didn't mention Master of Code. Like I was just there as a participant trying to learn startup world, which I totally respect. And so you just go to all kinds of different conferences, and finally you start figuring out like either it's a huge conference and you get lost there, it's too small and it's like people that are barely making it, or it's mid-level where people come there and they are after doing real business that you can achieve. Like it's not just SVPs of huge companies there, but it's like, you know, mid-level, mid-sized companies that you can still approach. They're still looking. They're looking to innovate. They're looking to see what's out there. They're looking to, you know, orient themselves in the new market trends. And if you can speak to some of those, they all of a sudden realize that a vendor they have worked with is a little bit outdated, is a little bit slow paced. And so they start entertaining the thought. And so you maintain that entertainment of the thought to the point where they're ready to give you something to work on. Like you buy in with a trial or like a soft launch of something or like something which is a low ask, and you work your ass off to deliver. And then it's kind of like a take, you know, a take in their head.
Is it mostly talking one-on-one to people and following up with them that led to sales or speaking?
No, it's personal connections.
Just personal connections. So what was your process? Did you have a process for taking a stranger and following up with them? What was it?
Like the biggest problem wasn't to follow up. The biggest problem was to like, you know, hit on a person and not be weird about it. I remember some situations like where I would hit on somebody who would be standing in a washroom and doing the business, and I would be doing the business by the side, and I hit on the person like that. And like it didn't turn into a lead, but like I realized, hey, I can take this to extreme and I can still make it work. So to me, it was a little bit of a game. Like
the game was, how do I go into an environment full of strangers and get them to understand what I do and get them in a conversation about it without being so weird?
Right. And you should understand that a person coming with a Soviet mindset, like, you know, with a lot of, like a lot of apprehensions, comes into an environment where everybody's, you know, speaking like freely and outgoing and things like that, that intimidates. Like a lot of the people from here still have a problem like freely communicating with clients. And that's a big part of what we do now. Like we get meetings with clients, like we go on site and we do like, Skype calls and things like that. And we push our teams to communicate. And that's like, that's a big piece of work that people have to go through because we're not, like we haven't been built for that.
You did though do some speaking. I mean, you yourself, like iDate, I happen to mention, you spoke at iDate, didn't you?
I did speak at iDate. I spoke at several, at multiple events, not a whole lot, but one of the things, like pretty cool pitching event that I was on was we started a startup called Presentane, and that was with Startup Bootcamp in Amsterdam 2013. And so we were the first ones to pitch in the cohort of 10 companies. And that was like a big event. So there was Nell Cruz there. That's the like the head of digital of the whole of Europe and the Queen of Netherlands. And it was like, it was awesome. Like it was set up by Startup Bootcamp in such an amazing way. And it was pretty cool. Like I got a lot of kick out of doing that one.
What happened with the Wi-Fi over there? An issue with your Wi-Fi for a reason?
Sorry, I thought you were meeting right now. how do you know?
I know, we got researchers here.
Wow, you're weird. Yeah. Like up there on the stage, being the first ones, and the company that was supposed to show how presentations are supposed to work from the smartphone via Wi-Fi or 3G in a very smooth manner, casting the slides in the big screen, all of a sudden goes
down.
That
was what your software did, yeah.
Yeah, but luckily the team there, like the CTO there, like oriented himself pretty fast, and there was a way to work through it. And they kind of had a backup, but to orient quite fast that, hey, Wi-Fi is off, like switch into this backup mode. They did it pretty elegantly.
Presentane, as in like combination of the word, I guess the word is portmanteau, a portmanteau of presenting and entertaining, or present and entertain, right? Yeah. It's still out there. The software is that one of the standalone businesses that you were talking about?
Yeah, that's a separate company. So we launched it in Amsterdam after the Startup Bootcamp, and the business is still running. Unfortunately, like this Wi-Fi issue is still begetting us.
Meaning, I go to a conference, I want to present, I can't count on Wi-Fi working, largely for the same issue that Steve Jobs had when he presented the iPhone 1 year, where everyone's on the Wi-Fi network and the Wi-Fi goes down, right?
100%. So the software is beautiful when it works. It allows people to get connected to the content, to the presenter. Like the whole experience works better and tighter, gets people connected and excited. But when it doesn't work, that puts presenter in a very, very tough spot. And so we lose clients like that. So they use it. It works when the infrastructure is right. But we're not in the business of making it possible for Wi-Fi to be stable, right? So in this sense, the business and the concept is earlier than the tech allows it to be.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website. You guys have updated stats on it. So far, 17,165 people have done presentations using this software, right?
Probably so, more.
A little more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But still not a big breakout hit. Individual company. What I'm curious about is, how did you find the time and the resources to do this? I can't tell you how many people were inspired by one of my earlier interviewees, Jason Fried, who started as a consulting company, said, hey, you just figure out your own problems and then you create software for it. And then boom, he created a bunch of companies, including Basecamp, which became a huge hit. And so a lot of software services companies said, we're going to get into software too. And they couldn't do it because there's not enough time, because it still costs money to hire developers, even if it's like part-time. And so they never were able to do it. Why were you able to do it? What did you have going for you that the rest of us can learn from?
Mm-hmm. I think there are two things. So first, there was a drive to innovate, right? And innovation is not only technology innovation. Innovation is like being in some context that you haven't been before. It's a challenge and you try to make it work, right? So getting into product side of things, not just service, was a context like that. So we wanted to make it work. And we tried that in the gaming industry. We burned through quite a bit of money trying to make it work. We published a game with Electronic Arts, but we didn't break even on it. So we had to close that direction down. There were a number of different failures. I don't want to count the money that we lost on those things. But we got quite a bit of good experience. And we haven't lost the desire to keep doing those things. So one of the things that really helped is that we're working and building this culture in the service business that is about ownership, that is about serving a client as if it's your own product. So you own the context in which you work. And that really helps the service because it builds, you know, for a much better relationship. Like the client really feels like you guys care. You're not just coding lines of code. You're not just task doers, but you're analyzing how it connects to the business, how, you know, like what's the best way to implement this feature, not because it brings you more money because you do 8 hours and not 4 hours of coding, but hey, I can actually advise you to do it like this, which is 4 hours and cheaper because I really feel this is a better case for you guys. It's going to work more elegantly, whatever, right? So when the client knows you have good of theirs in your mind, the relationship develops. So it's about long-term. And that's what we're building on the mindset of ownership, mindset of like really bringing out quality stuff that you're proud of.
So with this, how does that help you create your own products then?
That's what it leads to. So with this mindset, it really helps to now say, okay, guys, basically you have been crafting products, but for external clients. Now let's think up of different ideas that we can craft ourselves. And we're going to be treating it the same way, except we'll have to add on an arm of marketing or business dev. But the product is basically the same thing that you have been doing it before. And so, you know, the developers were taught to get deeper, understand the needs and validate the features, things like that. So like there's no shortage of ideas. I come across different people and there is a number of, you know, very bright people that know that, you know, Master of Code is a resource. It's growing, like lots of cool developers. Do you guys want to do a partnership on this product? And so what they would offer generally would be like marketing, maybe some finances and business dev. And we would do the implementation of the product. And so we actually got some of those partnerships going and we do have a number of different products that are out there. And some of them are performing well. And that turns out to be, working modal.
Does having the partnership also help with creating the product in the sense that now there's someone else counting on you? Now you can act. It's not like you're acting as if this is an independent thing, but it kind of is because it's in partnership with someone else, because you have obligations to someone else. You're nodding. Does that seem, because here's what I'm noticing. When people have consulting companies, they have a hard time saying, let's keep this developer working on this project when one of their clients needs that developer, when they should be selling that developer's time to someone else, right? Well, if you have an external dependency on that person and on that work, it's harder to say, let's bring that developer and that team onto one of our client projects. Does that sound right at all, or am I getting it wrong?
It does sound right when you're like 5 or 10 people company, right? So every time you drag a developer out of context that gets paid for by the client into something that is an investment, it's like minus 10% revenue, roughly speaking, right? So when you're like, 30 people company, well, you have a little bit of flexibility. When you're a 50 or 100 person company, you do have quite a bit of power and strength to work on some of those contexts with 2 or 3 developers on a team. And two or three developers can now make a difference. And we can have those developers working on that partnership for half a year to bring an MVP out. And if that MVP starts earning money, then that money goes into this next version of developing the product. And that organically keeps going.
I see. It also helps that you weren't just a five-man operation, but you had 50 people. And so three people out of a 50-person team is not as painful as having a five-man operation and then giving one full person over to a passion project. You know, the other thing that seems to have worked for you, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I'm just kind of going back in time and trying to analyze it. The fact that you would get into cutting edge technology gave you something new to talk about. So for example, I see in the early days you talking about mobile apps back when it was still fairly new. And so you're talking about mobile apps. That's something that the dating world, for example, wasn't far enough along on, and give you an opportunity to talk to them, right? Even if they end up hiring you to develop their site, they got to know you as the guy who can take them the step beyond the site when they're ready. Am I right with that?
100%. Yeah. So you got to be working on two things in your business. Like, it's the business you're in now, and it's the business you're going to be in a couple of years out. So like, you always are thinking, where is this going? Where is this moving? Because the companies that get stuck in the comfort of today, like, they're not strong companies a year or 2 years out. Like, the contracts expire, the technologies go down. If you don't, you know, keep innovating, you don't keep feeling out these new technology trends, like, you get, inadequated quite fast. So we're always doing some researches, we're doing some experimentations with technologies, and also, like, you know, some business ideas. So we have enough of the fillers out that we can kind of orient ourselves, and we can tell our clients, hey, we have tried these things. We know that it's coming, like chatbots. You got to be talking to clients about, you know, some things that are coming, even though that's not part of their technology stack yet. Like, they don't have it on their roadmap, but you start bringing cases out from, you know, kind of like a technology future, and that starts conversations. Then finally, you start finding some people in those companies that are pro innovation, and they bring that to their board meetings, and they start, you know, convincing the rest of the board that this needs to be tried.
And do they then hire you for this as a way of experimenting, or do they get to know you for this new here, let me get a little more specific. Imagine if I were starting a development agency right now, something like what you had in the beginning. There are a bunch of things that I could do that are today, like mobile apps and so on. And frankly, maybe even a little bit of web design even, or web development. But no one's going to give a rat's ass that there's another guy out there who can create mobile apps and websites. What I might want to do is say, well, we're in kind of July, August 2017. AR is coming, augmented reality. Apple's already announced it. I might want to immerse myself in that world and then start giving presentations about how augmented reality can help startups. So maybe I would even focus on e-commerce companies and then start giving presentations and writing posts about how augmented reality can help e-commerce companies sell more, right? And then they get to know me as the guy who knows augmented reality. Maybe they hire me for that, or maybe they hire me for the stuff that they already have, like running their e-commerce site, knowing that I can help them when the next step is here, which might be augmented reality or something else, but I've shown that I can go cutting edge. Does that make sense?
It totally does, except it's a big investment. Of these things that I have recently seen is Stefan, the guy that started Chatbots Live blog, and he invests quite a bit in there, and like, seemingly previously without a lot of the traffic coming in there that would convert into clients. But I know now he gets clients, and he gets some high profile clients, but there was a lot of upfront work done. So question is, are you passionate about, about that direction, about that trend, that you're able to invest into it like for half a year without really breaking even or, you know, like making anything considerable? If you are, and there is nobody doing that, like, you know, nobody big competing in that, like, it's worth to, you know, to be in that.
What's the name of the blog that you were talking about?
Chatbots Live.
Chatbots Live? Is it chatbotslive.com?
I have it in my...
I don't know them.
Yeah, I'll send you a link.
Okay. All right, but I get your point. You're saying, look, there's a lot of time just toiling away in this new technology where no one cares about it, and they're not ready for it, or they're curious, but they're not ready to invest. Okay. All right, let's come into chatbots in a moment. First, I'm going to talk about my second sponsor, and then we'll start to spend a lot more time on chatbots, which is how you and I got to know each other. The second sponsor is a company called HostGator. And you know what? When it came time for us to host our website, we had this new chatbot company called Bot Academy. When it came time for me to host it, I said, who do we host? Well, we went to HostGator, and we know that HostGator has got the lowest prices. In fact, if we go to hostgator.com/mixergy, we see the cheapest prices that they have available anywhere. But I know that their cheapest plans are not going to be right for us, because I don't want to share a server. I want them to be ready. I want a hosting company that can be ready for webinars that we do where we'll have 1,000 people on at the same time. And that doesn't mean the cheapest. That means something a little more powerful. Well, one thing I've learned with HostGator is if you start out with the cheapest plan, you can upgrade to some of the most powerful plans out there on the internet. And so we did it. We said, you know what? If I'm going to recommend HostGator, before we sign another contract with them, I need to be a customer of theirs on a high trafficked website. So we signed up for HostGator, then we upped our plan to the highest, beyond even with the cheapest starter plans. And then I said, bring it on. And we started buying ads promoting the fact that I was going to do webinars about chatbots. And we had hundreds, then thousands of people register for a webinar with me. And all of them for a webinar, they have to show up at the same time. Within 5 minutes of each other, they're all coming into the site all at once. And our website did not go down once. It was a pleasure to work with. And after that experience, I said, we have to get HostGator back as a sponsor. And so we did. And so if you're looking to start a website, I'm about to tell you about a URL where you can get a really inexpensive plan to get started. But I want you to also know that when it's time for you to upgrade, they have everything that you need. So here's a URL where you can get 50 to 60% off of their already low prices, and it's a great way to get started. You can have multiple domains on some of these plans, one-click installs of WordPress, which is what we use, WordPress, unmetered disk space, unmetered bandwidth, lots of templates, unlimited email addresses, tech support that's available any day, including Christmas, any time of day, including 1 a.m., and a 45-day money-back guarantee if you discovered that what I'm saying is not right for you and you want to switch out. So here's a URL. Whether you're starting out or you already have a company and you want to take it to a better hosting company, go to this URL. Go to hostgator.com/mixergy, hostgator.com/mixergy, and you'll see my logo right there at the top of the site, and I wouldn't give it to them, and I wouldn't partner with them unless I felt confident that they were a company I could stand behind and recommend to you. Go check out hostgator.com/mixergy. Chatbots. Why did you guys get into chatbots?
Because it wasn't was one of the new techs, and it was pretty easy to understand that if WeChat was as big as it got to be starting in 2013 in China, businesses were on it, and businesses were primarily dealing and transacting on WeChat versus any other platform, then, you know, like big players coming out with chatbot platforms wasn't about trying, it was trend setting. So if you wanted to be in that trend, you just got to dig in. And
but China, I mean, I don't mean disrespect to China, but they're kind of a weird market. They didn't have the established players that already grew in the US or Russia. They didn't have any of those players because they exclude Facebook, right? China's also kind of strange in that they didn't have much bandwidth. I remember doing interviews with entrepreneurs who happened to be in China. It was murder because the bandwidth was so slow. And so I could understand why chat would be better there. I could understand why that would be a better intro for them. But the US doesn't have any of that. Europe doesn't have any of that. Canada doesn't have that issue. Why did you see it as an opportunity that could go beyond China? The ability for companies to create apps, to create experiences called bots on chat. Why did you see that translating?
Well, a number of different signs. So Facebook coming out with that, like it speaks for itself. Like a big player like that does not just do something, with as big of a bang as they came out with. For just fun, right? It's trend setting. And if you want to get in there early, you're going to reap some of the early benefits, no doubts. And so platforms would come out one after another. So Microsoft would come out with, with their builder for Skype and other platforms. Like you could just see those things growing like mushrooms. And there wasn't a question asked that was going to be a trend, similar, like it was a technology shift, a platform shift. So web browser, desktop, mobile, okay, I can easily see how chatbots and chatbot platforms are going to be the next medium for interaction.
I see. You're saying they believe in it so much. It's already worked in China. I could see this. And plus, it seems like what you do is you try new technology with small percentage of your resources and see if it takes off. And so it wasn't like you were investing the whole business in this. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So like we cannot just make a stake on some technology shift, all of a sudden shift all our attention there, because there is not enough business to be made there. A lot of what's happening there is trial and error. A lot is research related stuff. A lot of it is like just trying things out. That's what I see a lot of the companies doing now with chatbots. We're just going to try. Let's build a chatbot. And that's a little bit of a problem because, now there is enough knowledge to how to do those things better so that they are not just one-offs that die and that tick box has been put that, hey, we have experimented with the chatbot and it sucks.
What's the first customer that you got for a chatbot?
So I should make a disclaimer here. We actually got helped to get in on this by Chatfuel. So the Chatfuel guys are the platform for building chatbots on the Facebook Messenger. Mm-hmm. And so I know the founder, Dmitry Dumik, and I that goes back like 6 years ago when we actually worked on Presentane and they worked on Panxi, which was a competing product. So we got to talk.
I didn't know he did that. Okay.
Yeah. And he was in San Fran. So we got to talk and that's how the relationship got formed. After that, they closed the company down because, they had the same issue, but they could read the signs better. And so they started working on Russian social network stuff. And we actually helped them out there. And
meaning then they hired you.
Yeah, they hired us to help with that. And then when we started the chatbot stuff, they said, hey, guys, looks like, there is cool stuff happening here and we're building out a platform. We got to keep the focus there, but we have clients that come in and want to be serviced. Like, do you want to be our vendor? And I said, no, let's try. Like, it didn't mean anything to me because I didn't know what a client is like when they're asking for a chatbot. And so we had to learn first how a chatbot is built. So Chatfuel shared their knowledge, best practices, and we kept regularly in touch to make sure what they're reading from like different clients and the market translated back to what we're talking about with the clients that come through them and consequently Facebook. So,
and the way it worked, it was this, and I had Dmitry on. I know Dmitry. I love that guy. I mean, really, not just like in a business love. I just really think he's, I like how, I'm not sure what to say that doesn't get into the personal stuff. I like how personally he shares his life and how he tries different things. Like, we'll chat for a bit and then suddenly he's got to go off on like a 7 or 10 day silent retreat where he's not talking. I also like how he talks about business. Like, he had this company that the one that you mentioned that was social media connected, that was pretty smart in the way that he created it and the way he sold it. And he's thinking very much like a bootstrapped, hungry entrepreneur, like your uncle who had you sell fish would appreciate the way that Dmitry works. And at the same time, he's got the polish of a funded entrepreneur here in Silicon Valley. Yes. But what happens is when somebody creates a bot on Chatfuel, there's a freaking logo, a label, a connection back to Chatfuel and every freaking bot. And you can't pay him enough. You can't say, hey, I'm friends with you. Can you remove it so it doesn't like advertise you? I want to just promote myself. And it's not that big a deal. It's kind of small. Most people don't even notice it. But what it does for him is the people who need it, who are exploring one bot, will say, how did this get made? Oh, it's Chatfuel that did it. They click over to that. They go over to Chatfuel. And many of them are big companies that don't want to go and like create a Chatfuel account for themselves. So they go to Chatfuel and they say, can you guys build it for us? Chatfuel says, no, but you know what? I got this other guy, Dmitry, who works at a company called Master of Code. We could refer you to them. We've known them for years. That's the way it worked.
Yeah. That's the way it worked like in the very beginning of the platform when it was like, smaller, but now it's like a completely different level. So they have seriously grown. They have a pool of vendors where they're, a preferred vendor, but they also have a number of other vendors across the globe. And they have a director of partnerships, like they have the whole process to manage the vendors and to make sure that, whatever the experiences get built for high profile clients, those are not just, like, here's a client, here's a lead, you deal with him, I don't want to hear about it. No, they take good care about
that. They manage that client too?
They on a very high level. But
what do they do? What do they do to make sure that when they pass someone on to you, that person is still taken care of?
they participate in some of the calls. They want to make sure that you bring back the information about that account and how that account is doing to see if they can help with anything, because they get a lot of internal insights from the platform, from Facebook, and they can get back and say, hey, this is how you would, you know, do this direction better, stuff like that. So
I see. That's impressive. Do they get a share of the revenue?
They amazingly don't.
Right. But what they get from it is they get some marquee clients. They get to say, here, look, all the bots that are built on our platform. And then also, when you build for a major company, they get all their users discovering ChatFuel, because you can't get rid of that ChatFuel link either. Yeah. What did you think of the fact that just a few days ago, Dmitry announced on stage that they are going to be building bots for clients now?
It's interesting. I don't know much about it yet, but it's a bigger company now, and it would probably make sense. They're looking for several streams of revenue, and it probably would be one of them. But the fact is that they're also talking about some paid subscriptions where they would not have the attribution to ChatFuel. So they play it smart. So they started and they wanted to grow big. To be able to grow big, they had to have these viral things, like, you know, to be free, to have this attribution. And so they have hit it. Like, they're like 46% of all the bots built on Facebook Messenger are ChatFuel bots, right?
Yeah.
So I think now they're in the second phase of trying to think, okay, how do we stabilize the business revenue-wise? And how do we make sure that we start earning now, which they rightfully should.
Yeah, maybe they should have done that from the beginning, started collecting payment from all these referrals, considering how much they were nurturing them. Okay, so that's where you got that. What I'm discovering actually is, let me broaden it away from your story. I feel like this happens a lot, that there is software that's really effective, but many big companies don't want to figure it out for themselves. They go to the maker and they say, can you do it for us? The maker says, no, we're in the software business. We have a lot on our hands right now, but we could refer you out. What I've discovered is, like, let's take email marketing automation. The more I've gotten to know Infusionsoft, the more I realize that they didn't advertise it in the beginning. I know that they don't make such a big deal out of it now, but when a big customer comes to them, they don't want to help that big customer set up their funnels and their tagging and all that. And so they have a handful of companies that they work well with, and they say, look, we are going to pass you on to them, you know? And that seems like a really good model. Tell me if I'm wrong again. If you're in a new space, to find the software vendors that you're using and go to them and say, will you refer clients to me? Here's the kind of work I could do.
That's a workable model. So, you know, on the side of ChatFuel, that's a way for them to scale faster. Of course, they're not making this money on the service part of the things, but they keep their pace on developing the platform and making sure the platform is, you know, is being the leader. And at any point of time, they can, you know, they can start all of a sudden growing their service part. So nothing precludes them to do so.
Do you think this would work in other places? Like, in other words, when let's stick with marketing automation came out. Would it have made sense to go to marketing automation companies and say, I'm really good at this. You should refer some of your biggest people to me if they don't want to do it themselves. I'm trying to think of what new technology is coming out right now. Nothing's really coming to mind. Yeah, would that make sense?
I haven't answered that part of the question. So it does make sense. And we have tried some of those things. And so if the market is saturated, if there are a number of platforms and it has been like, you know, 2 or 3 years of maturity in there already, then the ecosystem has formed more or less. And it's now a tougher competition. So you're going in, you should have some kind of portfolio, some kind of meat on the table so that they start considering you as a partner, as a vendor, as somebody who they can refer their clients to. Most of the times, like, the first wave of this happening would be their internal people, like this, you know, SaaS company internal people building out their network of partners. And from there, they, you know, they cover the bases, and then everything else grows on organically. That initial pool of partners gets the sweetest deal.
Once you said the ChatFuel intros were the beginning, what was the next step for you to get customers?
So when we felt that we more or less can position ourselves as a builder of chatbots that is not just a builder but understands the ecosystem better, we started doing some of the conferences and some of the meetups. And during those, like, so we have done a meetup in Winnipeg, for example, in Canada, where we have one of the offices. So we pulled together pretty cool sponsors, which was Deloitte, which was RBC, Royal Bank of Canada, and TDS, which is a big law firm. And we told them, hey, guys, this is new tech. We can see how it can get adopted by, you know, by your clients. So why don't we do this event with you, together with you guys? Like, we pay together for this event, and you, like, every one of you invites the biggest businesses you can think of to this forum. And so we prepped very good content. We thought of different ways that we can position the bots for their external dealings with the customers and for their internal team's efficiencies. So we talked about Slack. We talked about, you know, Messenger bots. And it was a very good round out, and we got quite a bit of leads and quite a bit of discovery sessions than with those internal, with those companies internally. That's how it gets, you know.
And like, so you do presentations, and the people from those companies, from law firm and for Deloitte, also do presentations. So everyone in the audience brings in guests, and everyone in the audience, every company that's co-creating this brings in their guests, but they're also presenting to all their guests, right?
Yes, but it was, you know, it was chatbot specific stuff. So we would do, you know, 95% of the content on that.
Why does Deloitte need to bring you in? What's their upside?
Because to them, it's like, it's a reputation of an innovator. Like, they can help their companies with new tech as well. So they have partners in their circles to, you know, to show their companies, you know, where it's all going.
I had a similar experience with TopTal when they were trying to grow their business here in San Francisco. They said, Andrew, would you come and moderate and ask questions? I said, yeah, I'll do anything for you guys. I want to see how you work. And they had, and I started asking how people came to the event. And it turned out it was three different organizations. I forget what they are. Each invited their clients to come to this event and learn about how to manage teams and how to develop and so on. I see, that's a really interesting model. And so you're on stage presenting. You can't pitch from the stage. You started saying that you did some demos. What was your process for taking people who are in the audience and turning them into customers?
So of course you're talking about it, and you're perceived as an expert, right? And so you were speaking about, you know, some cases that they can translate back to their operation. So you understand, like, you have a list of everybody who's gonna come, and so you start, like, with the team. We sat down and we said, okay, so if we're thinking about this like trailer production company, so where do we think a chatbot would fit? So internally, it will, like, be, you know, team communication on the inventory or, you know, whatever. And externally, it would be, you know, some campaigns driven from Facebook ads into buying trailers. And here's how you would form your audiences. So you would hypothesize on some of those ideas, and you would, you know, gently drop on some of those ideas in the, you know, in the presentation, which is not a rogue way to do. I mean, that's value. Like, they have come there not to listen to some technology shift. They have come there to hear about, you know, some specific cases and some ideas that would be applicable to their business. So it's completely proper. It's like, they're not there to just learn hypothetic stuff. They want to get back home with some specific ideas to discuss in their boardrooms.
I see. I want to know a little bit more. The Shopify evangelist, Ezra Firestone, I've had him on. I've known him for a long time. What's your connection with him, and how is he helping you guys grow your business?
Yeah. So we started working with Ezra probably 3 years ago, and we got acquainted with him through a guy that I got acquainted at iDate, which was, like, way back. So you never know, like, you know, keep making your connections. You never know when it's going to come out to something that really has worked out. So, Ezra is an amazing guy. He's like an amazing human being, positive. And so we started working with him for some of his Shopify clients, and it was just purely service business. But we really hit it off with him and started talking about stuff and just wanted to ideate. And so he came out with with this idea, Shopify apps, because he was becoming, you know, more and more of a heavyweight player in Shopify ecosystem. And he, like, with his Cindy, Boom by Cindy Joseph is...
That's his,
like,
product.
Yes. And it's amazing, like, trajectory of how he got a product, a partnership with a product people, and grew it so much and gets, you know, all the insights of how to do it properly and shares it with all the community. And is doing it so right. And we thought, yeah, it makes total sense. Now wrap that knowledge into Shopify apps and get people to benefit.
Wait, you created the Shopify apps for him?
We work with him in partnership on Shopify, on Zipify. Zipify is the company.
You or him?
So it's a partnership with him.
You co-own it too?
Yeah.
I see. So wait, if I understand you right, what I understand from him was he discovered by running his own store that after somebody buys, if you just have a one-click upsell or one-click follow-up sale, they're likely to click it. Shopify doesn't have that feature. So he said, I'll make it myself, meaning you guys made it for him. And then he said, I'm going to take this, turn it into a plugin for Shopify and sell it. And so he didn't hire you to do it. He doesn't own it exclusively. You guys co-own it?
Yeah, that's right. So we have been doing some of that stuff with him as a service. But then he says, hey, guys, like I can see this company really developing. And the only it's not that I don't want to pay for service. I would rather pay for service and contain the ownership myself. But I just know that if we are to make this big, I got to have a technical partner. So basically, we co-own this with him and we take care of all the technical part of things. And he takes care of marketing, of selling, of training. And he does a very good job of that. So he's not
such a good job of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he really brings that as value to people. It's not just selling apps. It's making sure people use them properly. People get the big bang out of it and it really increases their sale.
And he's given out the revenue for the business on in a past Mixergy interviewee that I past Mixergy interview that I did with him. But right. What's the share of the breakdown? What percentage of the business do you guys own?
Let me withhold that and exchange that for, he's still shared that already, but like the revenue the apps are making now is 75 to 100K a month.
Oh yeah, he did say that. But I mean, can you say what percentage of the business you guys own?
Unfortunately, I can't.
It's not 50-50 though, is it? It's more him than you.
I'll tell you that some of our partnerships are 50-50, but in this one specifically, I cannot disclose.
Okay. Yeah, because he does a ton of work around this one plugin. I mean, he's completely connected to it. It's not just his name, it's his cartoon character on the homepage, and it's his face in the about and throughout because he's got a good reputation in the Shopify ecosystem. But he sent you customers even before this. How did he send you customers? What was that deal?
Well, basically a customer would come to him and he would want to service that customer, but he didn't want to drop it, but he didn't really have time to service it with his internal team. So he would hand the customer over and he would be on a very high level managing the project. And he would try to, to do that less and less so that we can take ownership of managing the project so that he basically pumps deals. But then he realized that, just doing the service, it's still service business. He still could not unplug from that, just hand it over to us because sometimes we would not understand some of the intricacies of e-commerce. So he basically took us through, some educational and experience building period to where then we realized, hey guys, we now understand and it now can be, a partnership that is very balanced.
Oh, I see. I'm looking at his website. I don't see it now. He started out by teaching people and then he did some services, right? Where anyone could hire his team to do the work, but I don't see that on his site anymore. So
I don't think he does that anymore.
I see. So then he went from him doing it to saying, guys, can you take on more of this work? And he was the face of that interaction and then passing more and more of that work to you. And he got a commission and you guys got a stream of customers. So that's another way that you guys got customers.
100%.
I see. Oh, that makes sense. That's another interesting thing to partner up with someone who's an influencer and say, look, you don't just want to sell content. You don't just want to sell courses, but you can sell the services and we as an organization can fulfill those services. Well, got it. I see. Okay. So that worked for you. You know what? I've got a little more to ask you here. I know we're going a little over time here, but let's talk about the tough period, which was 2008. What happened to your company in 2008?
The thing happened to the entire world basically with the subprime crisis and, gradually it would come back into, budget being scaled down and the clients, dropping some of the projects and you're growing in the expectation of things at least not getting worse. Right. And when they drastically slow down, you stall, you have a little bit of a buffer to take care of the stall and still paying out to people who are your employees, not contractors. And I personally feel a lot of responsibility towards the people that we work with. It was exhausting because I realized that, like, I look at financials and I understand that next month stuff is not happening. Like, I'm not able to pay entire set of wages for the next month. So I started talking to some of the potential acquirers. I wanted people to move to somebody who could pay and you know, make a little bit of money on the forced exit. And it was a tough time because
you were trying to sell the company.
Yeah.
Because it was so bad you couldn't make payroll. And so as you were looking for someone to buy the company, what happened?
Thing was that I wasn't able to fire people. Like, I was not able to tell people, hey guys, let's now figure out who we're gonna fire so that we can pay for them. And maybe that's a weakling in me, but I ascribe it to like my care of people. People mean a lot to me. People I have worked with, I cannot just fire because like the economy slowed down. I believed we could make something out of this, but on the, you know, as a backup plan, I was also working on the possible acquisition plan. And so I got some interest, but then we got a client all of a sudden that was a fair sized client. And that client came in and I asked for a little bit of a, you know, down payment of the contract. And man, that was such a big relief. So I didn't hire anybody. Like a lot of the companies, sorry, I didn't fire anybody. A lot of the companies fired during that period of time were proud that we never have.
How did you find that client, the one that turned things around?
It was a connection that was random. Like, unfortunately, I cannot systematize that. It was a connection. All of a sudden, the phone rings. Hey, we have this project. We are talking to several companies. Would like to talk to you. And they didn't have that tech. So we had Ruby on Rails at that point of time. So they basically said, well, we're very interested. How many people can you get us? And so, yeah, we can get 20 people on it. Really? Like, are you able to balance that? I'll try hard. Wasn't the hard try because people said without work.
I want to close it out by understanding some of the nitty gritty of the business. Like, you told our producer onboarding was one of the big challenges for you. How do you onboard in a systemized way? What did you come up with? What's a good way to onboard new customers?
Was it about customers or was it about team members?
I've got onboarding of new clients as one of the challenges that you started doing it yourself, but you realized that there's just way too much to do. And then you handed it to the legal team, which I wasn't sure why you would hand it to a legal team. Maybe you meant, what's the system in the company that you're proudest of and that works because it's systemized?
Yeah. Yeah. So it probably is the way we hire people and we onboard people into the company and the culture. So I think that's like, we're very proud of the clients, but the only way that happens is that you can build a team that can service that kind of clients and the team that you're honestly proud of. And so to us, we had to build out something that really makes sure that the values we position are, you know, truly ingrained in people's minds. And that's a very tough piece of work. So to be able to find developers that are able to develop, like they have the skills, but also have the mindset is so, so tough. But then to me, it was becoming tougher to work in an environment where like people were just not sharing the same values. And so we started clarifying those values. We started making sure the culture is there and we started building out the HR department that would make sure that, you know, the values get translated, the culture keeps growing and keeps getting stronger, and that people that come in, the people that we attract, and we always were, you know, needing people.
How do you do that? What's the process for doing that?
So you build out your name, like you start doing stuff that really speaks of you as somebody who is a good employer.
Like what? I'm curious about how you do that in a systemized way for someone who's coming in. And sorry, I know I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah. So here's a number of things that you do. So you run some meetups. You support some of the good causes. You invest money into some initiatives in the city that, you know, people watch and know about. So you do a number of things that position you as somebody who is pro good for the world, for the community, right? And so people realize, okay, that's telling. I'm intrigued. So I would like to talk to that company, right? If they're considering several companies, they would consider the company that has a better culture with a comparable pay. They would consider a company with better culture. But to really make that work consistently and have people absorb that and practice that, that's tough.
So how do you do that in a systemized way?
So that's external. Internally, you have information that travels between everybody in a more systematic and like higher volume of that information. So if something's happening in the company, we get to know about it and we get to, you know, praise each other and we get to celebrate and we get to share experience. Like we have meetups internally happening several times a week where people, you know, talk about their projects. It's like public retrospective of a project where a team that worked on a project shares about the failures and the successes of a certain project and questions gets asked by everybody, right? So that we do events internally, like just cool events. Like we go out, we race cars, we drift cars. And it's like
you drift cars.
Well, yeah, like every spring we have an event that's in the local airport here in Ukraine. And we just get some rally cars in there and we have a lot of car fun. Yeah.
So how does that help you with your culture? I could see how that would create some bonding, but what am I taking away as an employee about how you guys work?
It's about sharing. It's about investing into employees, right? So I wouldn't be doing that if I didn't want to build out this bond. Bond is part of the culture, right? So also at those events, like we would come up with different topics and themes. Like we constantly keep bringing out like new challenges or new values that we're trying to practice. So like one of the recent things that we came up with was this: it's all about your launch. So you saw it on our website. So like what's the thing that everybody's really passionate about? We're passionate about launching new things. And our clients also want the same thing. They're apprehensive about their project not being launched. So like that's a new motto for 2017 for us. It's all about your launch. And we're making it happen so that launch happens on time, on budget, quality, and that clients are like, you know, they celebrate the launch. So it's more than just words. Like people really think this way. And they practice the stuff. And there's a big difference between the logo, the slogan, and how people feel. And we make sure that, you know, that's a daily practice. All right. If that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I think that I should do this, but I don't think it's in me to do it. But I'd love to have somebody go out and just interview companies about their culture. What it is, how they discovered it, how they pass their values on to their team, what they do to make their to show how their team should behave or not behave, but what how their team can express their values. I'm just fascinated by that, and I think that it helps create a better company. But it's the part of business that we just don't talk that much about. You got Tony Hsieh talking about company culture and values. You have a couple of other people speaking it, but no one's showing how companies actually express it. All right, the website is Master of Code. Do you know this guy, Sabin Shamsi?
Rings the bell, remind me.
He owns Masters of Code, but he's doing nothing with that domain.
Darn, we got to talk.
Right? Don't you think he needs to give that to you? Hang on a second. I want to call him right now. Let me see.
Let's do that.
Is this inappropriate for me to call him right now?
Why is it? No, keep on going.
Let's see. 510-378. I'm just call him up. Let's see. Sabin. He works at Angel Hack. Do people mistake your domain for theirs?
A couple times they did, yeah.
Let's see. Oh, sponsor a hackathon. That's what Angel Hack is. Let's see if we can get him on. Oh, I feel like he's trying to use the site. He's right here in San Francisco.
Sorry, I missed your call.
Oh.
Leave me a message, and I will get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you, and have a great day.
Shame on me, by the way, for just assuming that Sabine was a man. But yeah, Angel Hack is the company. You let me know. I will walk over to Sabine's place on 11th Street and introduce myself and see if I can make some kind of deal happen over here.
That'd be awesome. You have my support.
All right. I'd love it. And the website for now is Master of Code, because this is the Master of Code this company is. And man, I'm so excited to have heard your story. Thanks for being such a fan. Thanks for coming on here to do this interview.
Thank you, Andrea. Totally my pleasure. Thanks a lot for everything you put out there. That means a lot to a lot of people. That one time when I saw a guy in the taxi was listening, I was thinking, man, that's so cool.
I posted it on Facebook. There was Chris Winfield, a past interviewee, was in a cab in New York City. He says to the driver, what are you listening to? That sounds familiar. The guy says, it's just to start a podcast, or, you know, like he's not saying much because he doesn't think that Chris would know. He goes, wait, that's Mixergy, isn't it? The guy goes, you know Mixergy? And Anyway, Chris recorded it and posted it on Facebook. I love that. All right. Thank you. And thank you also to my two sponsors. If you're looking to hire a developer, go check out Top is in Top of Your Head, Tal is in Talent. That's toptal.com/Mixergy. And if you need somebody to host your website, use the company that's hosting our site. It's the bot site that we created that's been really well hosted by HostGator. Go check out hostgator.com/Mixergy. Dmitry, thanks so much for being here.
Bye, Andrew. Thanks. Appreciate it.